So welcome everyone. Do make yourself comfortable, because we're going to start with a bit of a story. And it's a story around the Buddha's teaching of the mindfulness of breathing. So mindfulness of breathing is no doubt a meditation practice that we've been familiar with for quite some time. And mindfulness is very much a thing at the moment. It's very in vogue. And a number of people are sort of emphasising that, well, you don't need to be a Buddhist to practice mindfulness. And I want to emphasise something different. I want to emphasise that the mindfulness of breathing is a very central teaching of the Buddhas. It's right at the heart of the Dharma. It was the practice that the Buddha was practising on the night when he gained enlightenment. So we can take you all the way. Okay, so as I say, we'll have a sort of talk section in the first part, and then we'll have a short lip stretch, and then we'll do some anapanasati practice, which is a sort of variant on the mindfulness of breathing. So over the course of these 8 weeks, 8 Mondays, we're going to be exploring the full teaching on the anapanasati, and we're going to be doing meditations that kind of relate directly to the content of the material for that particular week. So tonight we're going to be doing a meditation that's based on the first couple of sections of the full Anapanasati practice. But I'll introduce the whole thing as well, give you some context. So a little bit of context first. Anapana means in and out breathing. Sati is mindfulness. And the practice is called the Anapanasati Bhavana, the cultivation of mindfulness through attending to the breath in and out. And as I say, this is a somewhat broader, more elaborated teaching than perhaps the mindfulness of breathing practice that we're familiar with, the four-stage practice that we're familiar with. But don't think of it as a different practice. Just think of it as a sort of elaboration. And within that unfoldment of the exploration of the Anapanasati over the next 8 Sanghanites. We're going to be touching on quite a number of very core and actually hopefully very familiar aspects to meditation practice, to mindfulness and breathing, meditation practice in particular. But I'd like to just start with the sutta, and I wanted to read not quite the whole thing, but up to the teaching. So as I say, if you just make yourself comfortable and listen to a story. We have the story of the Buddha's teaching of the Anapanasati. So here's a teaching from the middle length sayings. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in Sarvati in the Eastern Park, in the palace of Migara's mother, together with many very well-known elder disciples. The Venerable Shariputra, the Venerable Maha Moggallana, the Venerable Mahakaspa, the Venerable Mahakachana, the Venerable Mahakotina, the Venerable Mahakapina, the Venerable Mahakunda, the Venerable Anuruddha, and the Venerable Revata, the Venerable Ananda, and other very well-known elder disciples. Now, on that occasion, Elder Bhikkhus had been teaching and instructing new bhikkhus. Some Elder Bhikkhus had been teaching and instructing 10 new bhikkhus. Some 20, 30, 40 new bhikkhus, and the new bhikkhus taught and instructed by the elder bhikkhus had achieved successive stages of high distinction. On that occasion, the apposite day of the 15th, on the full moon night of the Parvana ceremony, the Blessed One was seated in the open, surrounded by the Sangha of bhikkhus. Then, surveying the silent Sangha, he addressed them thus. Bhikkhus, I am content with this progress. My mind is content with this progress. So arouse still more energy to attain the unattained, to achieve the unachieved, to realize the unrealized. I shall wait here at Sarvati for the full moon of the 4th month. The bhikkhus of the countryside heard, the Blessed One will wait here at Sarvati for the full moon of the 4th month. And the bhikkhus of the countryside left in due course for Sarvati to see the Blessed One. And elder bhikkhus still more intensively taught and instructed new bhikkhus. Some taught and instructed 10, some 20, 30, 40 new bhikkhus. And the new bhikkhus, taught and instructed by the elder bhikkhus, achieved successive stages of high distinction. On that occasion, the Aposita day of the 15th, the full moon night of the fourth month, the Blessed One was seated in the open, surrounded by his Sangha of bhikkhus. Then, surveying the silent Sangha of bhikkhus, he addressed them thus: "Bhikkhus, this assembly is free from prattle. This assembly is free from chatter. It consists purely of heart wood. Such is the Sangha of bhikkhus. Such is this assembly. Such an assembly is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, an incomparable field of merit for the world. Such is this Sangha of bhikkhus, such is this assembly. Such an assembly that a small gift given to it becomes great, and a great gift greater. Such is this Sangha of bhikkhus, such is this assembly. Such an assembly is rare for the world to see. Such is this Sangha of bhikkhus, such is this assembly. Such an assembly as would be worth journeying many leagues with a travel bag to see. Such is this Sangha of bhikkhus, such this assembly. In this Sangha of bhikkhus there are bhikkhus who are arahants with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge. Such bhikkhus are there in this Sangha of bhikkhus. In this Sangha there are bhikkhus who, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, are due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes, and from there attain final nibbana, without ever returning from that world. Such bhikkhus are there in this Sangha of bhikkhus. In this Sangha there are bhikkhus who, with the destruction of the three fetters and the attenuation of lust, hate and delusion, are once returners, returning once to this world to make an end of suffering. In this Sangha are bhikkhus who, with the destruction of the three fetters, are stream entrants, no longer subject to perdition, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment. Such bhikkhus are there in this Sangha. In this Sangha there are bhikkhus who abide devoted to the development of the four foundations of mindfulness. Such bhikkhus are there in this Sangha. In this Sangha there are bhikkhus who abode devoted to the development of the four right kinds of striving, the four bases of power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven factors of enlightenment, of the Noble Eightfold Path. Such bhikkhus are there in this Sangha. In this Sangha, there are bhikkhus who abide devoted to the development of loving kindness, of compassion, of appreciative joy, of equanimity, of the meditation on boundlessness, of the perception of impermanence. Such bhikkhus are there in this Sangha. In this Sangha, there are bhikkhus who abide devoted to the development of mindfulness of breathing. Bhikkhus, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is a great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of enlightenment. When the seven factors of enlightenment are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance. And how, bhikkhus, is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated, so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? Here, a bhikkhu gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, sets his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful, he breathes in. Mindful, he breathes out. Breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. He trains thus: I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the body formation. He trains thus. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the body formation. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, experiencing rapture. I shall breathe out, experiencing rapture. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, experiencing pleasure. I shall breathe out, experiencing pleasure. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind formation. I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind formation. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the mind formation. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the mind formation. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind. I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind. I shall breathe out, gladdening the mind. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, concentrating the mind. I shall breathe out, concentrating the mind. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, contemplating impermanence. I shall breathe out, contemplating impermanence. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, contemplating fading away. I shall breathe out, contemplating fading away. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, contemplating cessation. I shall breathe out, contemplating cessation. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment. Because that is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, so that it is of great fruit and great benefit. So that's the core teaching. We'll be unpacking that over the coming weeks. There's no need for you to try and remember it. I've got a handout with that and this week's content on it. Some general points about the story to start with. So we're in this small town of Sarvasti, and the Buddha's staying there for the rainy seasons, which is a sort of 3-month season you get in India where it's pretty much raining the whole time. You probably relate to that. And it makes a lot of sense to stay in one place. You don't sort of churn up the mud traveling from place to place. It's looking after the land, and you can stay in shelter for one period of the rains. And these became long retreats that were traditional in the time of the Buddha, that for this 3-month period of the rains, bhikkhus would settle in a single place and spend that 3-month period on retreat, meditating, deepening their meditation practice. And here in Sarvasti, the Buddha's staying with a number of senior disciples. And there's a whole teaching program going on. The senior disciples are teaching the newer bhikkhus. And the Buddha's very pleased with the progress that's been made over these 3 months, and he's decided to stay on for another month and pursue, just keep that progress going, keep that sort of momentum going. And this teaching on the Anapanasati is the one that he gave at the end of that 4th month to the bhikkhus who'd been there for the whole rains, and also to bhikkhus who'd come in this 4th month. The rain season just beginning to come to an end, and people are moving again. And so knowing that the Buddha was there, these bhikkhus had come in to hear this teaching from the surrounding area. And here's this kind of pith, 16-point Anapanasati instruction. And its potential there to for this to be a full path all the way to enlightenment. And as I say, it's a practice the Buddha was doing on the night of enlightenment. So it's a lot of stages, 16 stages, but you can kind of group them into four what we call tetrads, and each one's associated with one of the foundations of mindfulness. So there's a group on the body, a group on feelings, a group on the mind, and a group on mental events. Each has got its own tetrad, and we're going to be going through those over the coming weeks. And as a whole, the practice includes aspects of samatha, of calm, concentration, absorption, calm abiding, and it includes, particularly at the end, aspects of vipassana, which is clarity, insight, knowing things as they are, a clear and definite awareness. And the Anapanasati instructions, it builds these two things together into a progressive path. So it's very much a bhavana practice. So this is the Anapanasati bhavana practice. Bhavana means cultivation and development. I want to say a few things about bhavana practice. So it's progressive. One's starting with one's own immediate experience as it is at the moment. That's the only place you can really start. And from there, you're progressing steadily through a number of stages that unfold naturally and organically. And this is based on the Buddha's teaching of conditionality. So bhavana meditation practice is rooted in the understanding of the Buddha's teaching on conditionality. So an aspect of that is that each stage gives rise to the next one as its sort of fruition, out of its fullness. It sort of overflows into the next stage. And this is something that's drawn out in a simile that's used for a description of the spiral path you may have come across. So I just wanted to draw this out as a sort of comparison. And so Lewis could give us a reading of this simile, if you'd like to do that. So this is from the gradual sayings, Anguttara Nikaya. Actually, you've got the one on the whole spiral, so... got two mixed up. Sally's got the one just with a single syllable, so we'll have Sally's first. Yeah.
Just as speakers, when rain falls down in thick droplets on a mountain top, the water flows down along the slopes and fills the cleft, gullies, and creeks. These being full, fill up the pools. These being full, fill up the lakes. These being full, fill up the streams. These being full, fill up the rivers. And these being full, fill up the great ocean. So too with ignorance as proximate cause. Volitional formations come to be with volitional... consciousness comes to be with liberation as proximate cause. Volitional formations come to be the knowledge of destruction.
Okay, so there's this image that's quite appropriate for the rainy seasons of the smaller containers are filled up and overflow into the next. So there's a tarn, there's a small lake in the mountains without any streams. It overflows into the streams into the rivers into the great ocean eventually. And so that's a metaphor to keep in mind in relation to progress through cultivation and development of bhavana meditation practice. And as I say, there is a close relationship between this Anapanasati teaching and this teaching of the spiral path. So both are this sort of progressive, augmentative cultivation and development. And some of the stages are quite akin to each other. So the next reading, which Lewis could do, is a reading about the spiral path. And it's particularly drawing out this aspect that you don't need to make a specific conscious willed effort to bring the next stage into being. The next stage will arise as a sort of fruition or overflowing or fulfillment of the next stage. So you just have confidence in that sort of natural process of conditionality.
Just as speakers, when rain falls down in thick droplets on a mountain top,
Bhikkhus, for a virtuous person, one whose behaviour is virtuous, no volition need be exerted. Let non-regret arise in you. It is natural that non-regret arises in a virtuous person, one whose behaviour is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition need be exerted. Let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no volition need be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one who is rapturous, for one with a rapturous mind, no volition need be exerted. Let my body be tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no volition need be exerted. Let me feel pleasure. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, no volition need be exerted. Let my mind be concentrated. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is concentrated. For one who is concentrated, no volition need be exerted. Let me know and see things as they really are. It is natural that one who is concentrated knows and sees things as they really are. For one who knows and sees things as they really are, no volition need be exerted. Let me be disenchanted and dispassionate. It is natural that one who knows and sees things as they really are is disenchanted and dispassionate. For one who is disenchanted and dispassionate, no volition need be exerted. Let me realize the knowledge and vision of liberation. It is natural that one who is disenchanted and dispassionate realizes the knowledge and vision of liberation. Thus, bhikkhus, the knowledge and vision of liberation is the purpose and benefit of disenchantment and dispassion. Disenchantment and dispassion are the purpose and benefit of the knowledge and the vision of things as they really are. The knowledge and vision of things as they really are is the purpose and benefit of concentration. Concentration is the purpose and benefit of pleasure. Pleasure is the purpose and benefit of tranquility. Tranquility is the purpose and benefit of rapture. Rapture is the purpose and benefit of joy. Joy is the purpose and benefit of non-regret. And non-regret is the purpose and benefit of virtuous behaviour. Thus, bhikkhus, one stage flows into the next, one stage fills up the next stage, for going from the near shore to the far shore.
So we've got that natural progression from a secure ethical practice into a natural unfoldment of meditation through experiences of pretty and sukha into tranquility and concentration, and from there a sort of a natural unfoldment of seeing things as they are through, in the words of the spiral path, sort of withdrawal from the world and knowledge and vision of the destruction of greed, hatred and delusion. And in the words of the Anapanasati, there's this natural progression through concentration is built on pretty and sukha into absorption, and then into a sort of a natural unfoldment of seeing the impermanence of things as they are. And there's this fading away, cessation, relinquishment, which is just sort of settling into that way of being that's just at home with impermanence. So that's the whole path. Now we're just starting where we are, starting where we're at, and sort of pursuing the path from there to whatever extent we're able. But the qualities that I wanted to draw out from those, particularly from those two sutras, are the qualities of bhavana practice. And it's saying that it's not a willed effort, so we're not sort of cultivating, developing mindfulness as the forced result of a willed effort. Having said that, we do need to make an effort, but the effort we need to make is a sort of balanced persistence. It's like an endeavour to establish conditions persistently, repeatedly, patiently. And it's also working on whatever estranges us from meditation. So whatever is kind of behind our resistance to meditation, it's kind of trying to understand that and work on that, work around that. And it's as much a letting go as it is a bringing about. So the effort is to sort of let go of what hinders us, what estranges us, what prevents us from naturally moving forward. And so this close association between the sort of natural dynamic behind the bhavana meditation practices, the metta bhavana and the mindfulness of breathing, the anapanasati bhavana, is kind of taking the nature of conditionality into account. So there's this parallel or close association between the meditation practice and the nature of our experience, the actual nature of the reality of our experience. And that's sort of indicating why, or in what way, there's a very close relationship between the Anapanasati as this cultivation practice and insight. And the close relationship is that we're kind of working with the way things are, and we're seeing directly in our own experience how things unfold in the way of conditionality. So we're seeing conditionality directly, and we're actually engaging with conditionality directly as it is. Yeah, so that sort of suggests why it might be that Vipassana practice sort of very naturally kind of emerges from or unfolds from the mindfulness of breathing, Anapanasati Bhavana. So as we're developing this clarity in our perception of the quality of our mental states and of the way in which they kind of affected by changing conditions, then we'll see the nature of that sort of conditioned co-production, that conditioned arising more directly and more clearly. So moving on to the sort of more particular instructions, the more specific instructions in the sutta. So the Buddha says that bhikkhu goes to the forest, to the foot of a tree, to an empty place. So he's stressing here the importance of a good context, a good environment in which to practice. And here we are in a very supportive environment for meditation practice. It's not a forest, the foot of a tree, or an empty place, but it is a place of practice, a place of quietness and stillness, and a place that's conducive to meditation. So the place is important, and there's that sort of emphasizing there is a sort of positive value to coming and participating in collective practice here at the center. It's also worth reflecting on how much of the sort of quality of the place of practice is something that we're all individually bringing to it. So the more we can be still and quiet and deep in our own meditation practice, the more supportive we're going to be making the context and the environment for everybody else that's here that's practicing meditation with us. And that's something we can kind of share. So next, the bhikkhu sets his body erect. That's just this one little one-liner, but it's sort of emphasising the importance of posture, which I think we've been through quite a few times. So qualities of groundedness, of stability, qualities of uprightness, of balance, poise, qualities of openness, they're all there in the posture. And you can imagine the bhikkhu's got all of that in his sitting erectly. And he establishes mindfulness, so we're bringing our mind into our current experience, establishing mindfulness. And here we start with the first of the first tetrad, the first two instructions of the Anapanasati. One trains himself. Breathing in long, I know I breathe in long. Breathing out long, I know I breathe out long. One trains himself. Breathing in short, I know I breathe in short. Breathing out short, I know I breathe out short. And we take these two together. And the reason we're taking these two together is it's not a breathing exercise. So I hope everyone's familiar with that aspect of the mindfulness of breathing meditation. It's not a breathing exercise. It's not like prana yoga or something like that. We're not trying to breathe long. We're not trying to breathe short. What we're doing is noticing the length of our breath, however long or short that is. So you begin your investigation of the experience of the body breathing with that sense of its duration, and in parallel with that there are sort of qualities to the breath. So a rapid breath will have a certain type of quality to it, a long, slow breath will have a very different sort of quality to it. So notice the lengths, notice the quality. It's also worth at this point noticing the location, noticing where you're actually experiencing the body breathing. So on the duration, it varies from individual to individual, but what we're really looking for us, as we are more or less at the moment, at this stage in our lives, is this, are we breathing shortly and rapidly, more quickly than usual, or are we breathing slowly and relaxedly and much longer than usual, or is it somewhere around about in the middle? Now, as we relax, the breath will tend to lengthen, but we're not trying to do that deliberately. We're not trying to lengthen the breath in order to relax. It's the other way around. So we're just allowing the body to find its natural rhythm of breathing and following that with awareness. So in terms of qualities, it could be rough, it could be smooth. So perhaps a rapid breath, you might be sort of some exercise and out of breath, and you might have that kind of harsh quality. You can sort of imagine a sort of metaphor in this, sort of imagine like a material and think, well, is it rough, or how rough? Is it sort of something like burlap or hemp, or is it more like linen, or maybe it's sort of wool, or actually if it's quite smooth, it might be more like lamb's wool or even cashmere or silk, you know, really silky. Maybe sort of trying to evoke sort of quite which sort of texture it's got. Is it free, or is it being held onto? Is it an easy sort of experience, or is it laboured? So there's qualities. So it's kind of alongside that sense of length and duration. And along with those, perhaps we might spend more time investigating location. So the location here is the location of the physical experience of the body associated with the breath. Now, we're particularly looking to choose as our focus, as our object of meditation, the direct experience. And we're not looking to choose as an object, a concept or an idea. So you want to look out for the idea. We're liable to have an idea of the breath, an idea of when we're breathing in, an idea of when we're breathing out. So we can't really prevent ourselves from having that, but we're choosing a different focus. We're choosing the focus of the actual physical experience. And that has a number of benefits. It's always in the present moment. So physical experience is always happening now. And it's always different, it's always varying, it's always kind of in a process of change. Conversely, a concept is something quite static. It doesn't really change from one breath to the next. So watch out for sort of attending to an idea of what the breath is and identifying with an idea of doing the mindfulness of breathing. As I say, ideas are sort of fine, have them in the broad awareness. Don't try and do anything to them or stop having concepts, but choose a different focus. Choose the focus that's the actual experience. Now, I don't know if any of you have come across a teaching of the mindfulness of breathing that's along the lines of following the breath, and you sort of, perhaps it's described in terms of the breath coming in the nose, and it sort of goes down your throat into your stomach, not stomach, into your lungs, and then turns around and then comes back out again. Is that familiar? Okay. Can anyone see a flaw in that teaching? No? Probably rings a bit false with that. Well, just sort of think, what is one's actual experience of the breath? What is it that's actually coming in and going into your lungs and then coming out again? And so there's that, which is sort of the air, if you like. So there's a good quantity of air that sort of comes in through the nose, down through the throat, into the lungs, turns around, back out through the throat, out through the nose. So that's air. Now, we don't have any nerve endings in air. We don't actually experience air directly. So what we're actually experiencing, perhaps we're experiencing the movement of air across the hairs in the nostril. Perhaps we're experiencing a change of temperature as the air is coming in cold and going up warm in the nose. We're probably also experiencing a movement, like muscles moving. So that's a sort of touch experience that's in the abdomen, in the ribs. Now, none of that experience actually, tracks this packet of air that starts at the nose and goes down into the lungs and then turns around. So if you look at what you're experiencing when, it's not like your experience starts here and then it goes to here and then it comes down here and it goes back out again. If you look at what your actual experience is, well, there's this range of experience, and it does kind of change as the cycle of the breath unfolds. So as you breathe in, hold, and gradually breathe out, quite what you're experiencing changes, but it's not like it's just a point of experience that starts here and then comes down and then goes back out again. So it's worth kind of looking at, well, what actually am I experiencing? So for myself, I sort of noticed, perhaps the first things I notice are, there's a movement in my abdomen, and there's this kind of light sense of touch of the air sort of moving through my nose. And I can't myself quite tell which one of those happens first in experience. I've got a sort of feeling that it's probably the abdomen first, and then the air's sort of drawn in. But it all seems to happen at the same time to me. And then later on in the breath, there's a sort of lung. It's like the abdomen comes down and then the lungs expand. So the chest, rather, sort of expanding. So there is this sort of movement that quite what I'm experiencing where does kind of move around throughout the cycle of the breath. But it's not something kind of coming in and going out again. That's not something I'm directly experiencing. So you see the difference there is that this idea of the breath is sort of associated with the air, and it's kind of coming in and it's going out, and there's that idea that's what the breath does, it comes in and it goes out. But it's not actually our experience. And it's our experience that we want to choose as our object, that we want to focus on. Okay. So, location. Think in terms of, three dimensions. So it's like all the way from tip of the nose all the way down to the abdomen. There's also the sort of perhaps the rib cage, left and right. And try and think three-dimensionally as well. It's surprising how often we sort of think of ourselves as a sort of flat front or surface. But actually, you know, there's a depth to our chest and there's a depth to our experience. So try and sort of, just explore that whole torso and see what's actually happening where. Okay. So the last couple of points I wanted to add in before we'll take a break and then we'll do the meditation around these first two stages is on qualities of balance. So we're attending to the experience of the body breathing, and that's our focus, that's our chosen object of meditation. It's that particular physical experience of the body moving as the breath comes in and out. And it's a good focus. It's good because it brings us into the body, and the body is where we're kind of holding our feelings and emotions. So a whole experience is going to have this feeling tone. It's going to have this kind of pleasurable or painful feeling tone, and that's kind of held in our physical experience in our body. And our emotions, our sort of resistance or our engagement, they kind of tend to cluster around these feelings. So if there's something kind of painful going on, then our kind of resistance to meditation will probably kind of cluster around that. So this is kind of likes and dislikes, but it's also accepting, rejecting, engaging, resisting, that sort of emotional, sort of volitional side. And the breath is also very good because as a physical experience, it's something that's kind of very direct and immediate and in the moment. So we can let go of concepts and move into direct experience. Now, it is possible to have a direct experience of what the mind's doing, of thoughts and concepts, but it's very difficult. And I think for myself, I certainly find that physical touch experience is the one that I can most easily engage with directly as it is, without particularly labelling it. So it's good in that sense. What about all this, the other stuff that's happening? So we're focused, but we're not trying to be narrow or exclusive about that focus. And so there's a breadth of experience around this particular focus. And that's going to include a whole range of things. Pretty much everything else is welcome in that breadth. So all of the other bodily experience, there's going to be more going on than the experience of the body breathing. Particularly, there's probably going to be a sense of groundedness. There might be some aches around the knees. There's some whole experience of the lower body that's there. The breath is all happening here. There's sense perception, there's sense experience. So the other one that's going to be really particularly live is liable to be sound, hearing. So when you're meditating, your eyes are closed, there's not much going on visually. There's not much going on in terms of smell and taste. You might sense a bit of incense, perhaps, but it's going to be so in the background that I certainly find that I'm usually not particularly aware of sight, smell or taste during meditation. But whatever's coming in, probably sound, whatever's coming in, just allow it to be there. And you can have a sense of expansiveness in that breath. So this is something that sounds in particular can give you. You might notice the sound of traffic going by. Now that's quite a distance away. And if you can kind of just take that in your broad awareness, it sort of expands your breadth of awareness all the way out to the Gloucester Road, all the way out to where that sound's happening. So sense perceptions, also feeling tones, volitions, emotions, thoughts, anything that's happening in one's mind. Sometimes these things really want to crowd in to become the main story, the focus. What we're trying to do is allow them to be there, but not focus on them. So we're allowing them to be there in our breath, in our broad awareness. So that's the sort of distinction I was quite keen to get across. We're not trying not to think, for example. We're not trying not to have a concept of the breath. We're not trying, you know, in a way we're not trying to have a different experience of the one we're having. What we are endeavouring to do is choose a different object, choose a different focus. So I'm not trying to pretend that all of this stuff isn't happening. I'm not trying to make it stop. I'm just choosing to attend to this different thing, to this particular experience of the body breathing. And then in the breath, you can just leave things be, and they'll hopefully settle in their own way. So that's balance of focus and breath. And the last point was balance in the sense of effort, so balanced effort. So what is a balanced effort? Now this relates quite directly to these metaphors or these kind of descriptions for the way in which conditionality works, the way in which a progressive path unfolds. And it's not necessary to make a willed effort to bring the next stage about. So the effort we're making in meditation, it's not like we're trying to be somewhere else. You know, it's not like I don't like being here, distracted. I want to be there, concentrated. I'm going to make a willed effort to be concentrated and to stop being distracted. That's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to kind of really inhabit our experience where it is and have a gentle push in a certain direction, the direction of attentiveness, if you like. And so balanced effort, you can think of this in terms of how much effort to make. And I think one good answer to that is as little as possible. Make as little effort as possible. One of Vasantra's little teachings last week on meditation retreat was try and think of meditation as a leisure activity. You know, try not to think of meditation as a work activity. So it's like, it's an opportunity to really relax and kind of come into ourselves and put the day down. Come home to our experience in our body, really, relax. We are trying to stay focused. We are trying to keep this particular object, this particular part of our experience in the centre. So we're making a little effort to do that. Try and make that as little effort as possible. The other way of putting that is as much effort as necessary. So, you know, if it takes a bit more, well, we'll need a little bit more. the quality of our effort is more about persistence. It's more about keeping on trying. It's not about, you know, furrowed brow. So if you find you're sort of leaning forwards, I used to find this quite a bit in meditation, I still watch out for it. Subtly kind of leaning forwards. And for me, that was it wasn't the falling asleep leaning forwards, it was a sort of pushing forwards. And I'd find, watch out for what's going on in that bit of skin between your eyebrows. So if you're making quite a willed effort, it'll tend to kind of furrow up. You know, I think of it a bit tight around there. So there are kind of telltale signs you can look out for. Well, oh, a little bit willful, a little bit too much effort. Nonetheless, there is a sort of, so there isn't this kind of leaning forwards and frowning type effort, but there is a sort of, there's almost a sort of leaning into our experience. So there's this phrase of Pema Chodron I really like. She, along with many people, particularly Chogro Trungpa's disciples, talk of turning towards, so turn towards our experience. So particularly here, we're turning towards this physical experience of the body breathing, turning towards it. And Pema Chodron goes further and says, lean into it. Just a slight lean into experience. So there's that sense of directionality. But it's not a willful effort. And hopefully we can find and develop and discover a sense of interest and enjoyment in what's actually happening. If you take an interest in what's going on, particularly if you're attending to your actual direct experience, it's something interesting. So concepts are pretty boring, really. The idea of I'm breathing in and the idea of I'm breathing out, after a while, that gets pretty boring because it doesn't change. It's just the same old idea, same old breath. Here it comes, breathing in again. Didn't I just do that? You know. The particular immediate in the moment physical experience is something that's always changing. It's something that's always richer and more subtle and more nuanced than one realizes at the moment. And it's something you can take an interest in. It's got enough richness there to actually engage your mind. And so kindly, patiently, attentively, we're sort of turning towards taking an interest in, engaging with what's actually happening with our body breathing, our experience. And so if you're familiar with the factors of concentration, the dhyana factors, the first one is turning the mind towards vitarka. The next one is bearing in mind vichara. So we turn towards our experience and we kind of bear it in mind, we keep it in mind, we explore it. There's a sense of continuity of application there. And if you can really kind of connect with those qualities, turning towards, bearing in mind, then from that a sense of interest and engagement and enjoyment sort of develops, and a sort of more positive emotional or at least feeling tone. Qualities come in, and this is where these sort of factors of pretty and sukha come in. So pretty is this sort of physical enjoyment, so physical perhaps sort of skin tingling, sort of vitality, sense of lift. And sukha is a sort of mental state, so it's a sense of happiness, a sense of contentment, a sense of just really being comfortable inhabiting your experience here and now. That's sukha. And so my suggestion is, if you can really turn towards and engage with your experience, then you develop this sort of qualities of interest and enjoyment and engagement, from which a sort of more positive sort of feeling tone sort of develops. Even if your physical experience is quite painful, the awareness itself is going to be enjoyable. Awareness in itself is actually a very pleasurable experience. So there's going to be something there that has that sort of positive feeling tone. And as these come together, then the mind's kind of entering a state of absorption. So you can see it as a sort of natural building, a natural development, coming together of factors into a sort of more one-pointed state of mind, which is absorbed on the object, on the breath. So those are my chosen topics, teachings for the opener, for this first evening on the Anapanasati. We've looked at what to focus on, so the particular experience of the breath, not controlling it, not controlling the length, but looking at its duration, looking at its quality, looking at its where it is, the location, really engaging with that. Surrounding that focus and engagement with a broad awareness that's not excluding anything, that's allowing everything to be there. Just choosing a different object, but not trying to stop anything. And sort of cultivating, developing those kind of factors of engagement with a sort of balanced effort. So that's a sort of conclusion, that's a sort of summary around the aspects of the mindfulness of breathing practice that